afternoon. We have case number 96-0688, City of Racine versus Rate. Rate is an intervener appellant. Representing Rate is Patrick Huddock.
Thank you. My name is Patrick Huddock of East Troy, Wisconsin. Thank you. I represent RATE, which is an acronym for Residents Against Trash Expansion. It's a citizens group of neighbors around the proposed City of Racine, a landfill known as Land Reclamation. The issues before the court have been fully briefed and basically relate to the applicability of the Notice of Claim Statute 893.80 to both the facts of this case and to cross and counterclaims in general, as well as to the court's interpretation of this matter in two recent court decisions. One, of course, is Waukesha, DNR versus City of Waukesha, the other being last May's decision of Bacaloff versus Town of LaGrange, where the court did hold that the notice of claim statute was not going to be applicable across the board, but there were going to be exceptions. In that case, the court carved out the open government exceptions. And this case presents another difficulty the legislature has left us all with when it redrafted the notice of claim statute to remove damages and then have it apply across the board. I'm going to be addressing three issues very briefly, hopefully anyway. So one of which is the applicability to cross claims and counterclaims. Secondly, the applicability of the claim statute to Chapter 227 appeals, where there's a 30-day petition requirement and also the ability of other parties to participate in that appeal. And finally, ask the broader interpretation of the notice of claim statute and the difficulties I just related. The facts of this case is somewhat complicated and have to do with the landfill siting. I'll try not to be too repetitive with what's in the brief, but it's important to see where the parties are situated. The landfill siting law, formerly once Section 144.445, now Section 289.33, generally permits affected residents and municipalities around a landfill to participate in what's called a siting process to address the legitimate concerns that the legislature has recognized neighbors and affected municipalities have. The statutory framework permits municipalities which are affected to participate and get involved in a negotiating process. This is an unusual case where we had the town of Mount Pleasant, originally the host community, had four members, Racine County two members, and the city of Racine, which is close by, as one member. Halfway through the process, or at least into the process, the city of Racine decided to annex the landfill and create a peninsula, and by virtue of that, then became the host municipality, and therefore comprised a 4 out of 7 majority. This affected the negotiations substantially, as basically the town of Mount Pleasant and the neighbors felt that they were written out of the process, even though they were most affected. Now, the issue that this court is faced with, at least to start out with, is the attempt by the town of Mount Pleasant and the neighbors, as well as Racine County, by the way, to disqualify the city of Racine from negotiating because the city had a long history of having contacts and contracts and financial involvement and potential environmental liability, as well as some payments coming from the landfill to the city. The landfill siting law is set up like most negotiations. You have parties on the opposite sides, on opposite sides of the table. Under 144.445.6E, it says if a municipality either is the proponent of the landfill or contracts with the operator, then they're disqualified from negotiating with the residents and municipalities affected because they really don't have separate interests. Hence, that frames the issues of where we get to the Waste Facility Siting Board. Because the town and county and residents felt that the city should be disqualified because they had a contractual obligation to run the landfill under certain circumstances, is that they applied administratively to disqualify the city. Eventually, these claims were brought to the Waste Facility Siting Board, which does have statutory authority to implement certain rules to assist in the negotiating process under 239.89 sub 6 sub E. So we had an administrative hearing then before the Waste Facility Siting Board, where the issue of the city of Racine's ability to qualify as a negotiating municipality was held. At that time, all the affected municipalities came in and made a presentation to the Waste Facility Siting Board. Rate was there, though their party status wasn't yet determined. They were permitted to participate, but they weren't a party. In any event, the city of Racine lost. The city of Racine then filed a Chapter 227.52 appeal, and they did so within 30 days. They were suing a governmental body, the Waste Facility Siting Board, didn't file a notice of claim, but followed, I think properly, the statutory procedure under 227. Once that was done, the town, the county, and rate all filed their notices of appearance. They responded to the city's petition saying, no, city, you're wrong. The Waste Facility Siting Board was correct, and that should be upheld. What thereafter happened was the city of Racine opposed rates standing as a party. Reid's motion to intervene was finally heard after intervening and filing their notice of appearance in December of 1994. They were finally granted party status by the circuit court judge in April of 1994. The town of Mount Pleasant then filed a counterclaim to the 227 proceeding in late April, and Reid then filed what's now before you as a counterclaim and response against the town's position, and also a cross-claim for declaratory relief against all of the other parties. And in that cross-claim, Rate basically said, we want the court to adjudicate all the issues on the 227 appeal and any issue that may relate to it. It's our contention that the counterclaim and cross-claims in this case differ substantially from the court's previous decision in 1974 under City of Milwaukee versus Milwaukee Civic Development, 71 with second, 647, again a 1974 case, where a separate monetary claim was filed, a counterclaim was filed back against the city in that case. In that case, the court said that if a money demand is separately and affirmatively pled, the notice of claim statute should apply. Now, whether or not that's good law under the current legislative change of the notice of claim statute, I don't think really matters here, because that is entirely a separate issue. In the case we have here, the city of Racine, under 227, sued the Waste Facility Siting Board, in essence, under an appeal, and also sought additional declaratory relief, saying that, amongst other things, the Waste Facility Siting Board didn't have jurisdiction to hear that particular issue. They wanted declaratory relief saying that they could, in fact, negotiate in the siting process. That's the issues the city of Racine framed. Now, in response to that, all the parties that participated in the administrative review proceeding got on board, intervened, as provided in Chapter 227, and then they presented their own response to the city of Racine. Therefore, number one,
can I just ask you a question? I'm busy searching for the cross-claim and counterclaim. I found the City of Racine summons and complaint. In that cross-complaint and counterclaim, are they asking anything else, or is it really a negative to the city's complaint?
It probably could be described as negative to it. In other words, it basically is a counterstatement to the city's position.
They want to. I'm asking, does Rate want a declaratory judgment saying that the siting board has jurisdiction and can't negotiate, or at least has jurisdiction?
Yes, Rate's initial notice of appearance and response to petition for review is framed as a 227 response, okay? And that asks for relief, affirmatively requesting the court to affirm the decision of the Waste Facility Siting Board. And that answer was slightly responded to once the town of Mount Pleasant itself filed an amended counterclaim. Now, the city, in argument for the trial court, said they didn't have any problem with the town of Mount Pleasant staying in. They thought they comply with the notice of claim statute. So now we have the City of Racine on one side challenging the Waste Facility Siting Board, the Town of Mount Pleasant on the other, trying to uphold it, but also counterclaiming for relief. Now, the other
part, kind of relief?
For a declaratory relief, not only addressing the holding up of the Waste Facility Siting Board, but pleading in the alternative that if, in fact, the board didn't have jurisdiction to decide the issue, that the circuit court go ahead and decide the issue itself.
Okay. Who can sit on the board? That's the issue, right?
On the negotiating committee,
okay,
yes.
So that's Mount Pleasant. What was your client's counterclaim?
After the Town of Mount Pleasant filed theirs, we filed a highly plagiarized adoption of their pleadings and adopted the same claims for relief.
Okay. So it was really the negative to what the city was asking for.
Yes, and in fact, you find the wherefore clauses are practically identical.
All right.
Let me ask you, just when you boil 893.80 down, it basically is a notice giving the city or the litigant an opportunity to negotiate and possibly settle the dispute. If we were to go ahead and adopt your position and make another exception, as we did in the case following DNR, the Auctious case, Auckland case, why wouldn't you want, or, you know, this applies to other cases other than this one, but isn't the idea of possibly settlement and negotiation a good policy behind 93.80? In other words, why would this be treated differently just because it's a counterclaim? Even though they knew it, they could possibly still negotiate and settle this, right? Is there any reason why that couldn't be done?
Well, I think there's a distinction here. I think that old 74 case I referred to, the City of Milwaukee case,
right,
which set a separate monetary claim, which perhaps if it's unrelated to the city's own claim, if that's brought, maybe the notice of claim should apply in that case so that can be separately negotiated. Now, the complexity
there...
Well,
that's what I don't understand. Why is this
different? This is different because Chapter 227 itself calls for a specific procedure. There are at least 41 different statutory inconsistencies with 893.80 if it's to be held in all cases. That is, that have it called for statute limitations anywhere between 5 days and 90 days. At least 41 of those, in addition to this one, so there's actually 42 that I've been able to find. There might be more. Therefore, 893.80 is inherently inconsistent with at least 42 statutory sections. Two of them were found in the Auckland Law cases, which I had the pleasure of arguing last year, and the other ones are not yet addressed, and perhaps are all in the pipeline coming up to visit you. Annexation cases, zoning cases, election cases.
With that as a foreboding of 42 more cases of this nature, let's see what we're doing on this. How broad of a holding are you asking? I know your argument now, and in pages 11 and 12 of your brief, you mention all of these other exceptions, if you will, to 893.80. How broad of a holding are you asking of this court?
Well, as I said in my last argument in Auchinlock, I'd like both. I'd like a specific finding, but also I'd like the court to address the inherent inconsistencies here. If you see across the board, as a general rule of interpretation, wherever there's a specific statute, it's going to control over 893.80 as the general claim statute. I think that's going to cure a lot of problems out there.
Say that again, would you please?
If the court holds the specific statute, if each of these specific statutes with a separate procedure or a separate statute of limitations or period of limitations controls over the general notice of claim statute, 893.80, then I think you've reconciled the problem the legislature left us with.
Well, now what's the specific statute here?
The specific statute here would be 227, specifically under point 52 and point 53. I think the statute is clear enough that once a city receiving, in this instance, filed an appeal over a general subject matter, anybody that had participated in the administrative review process or could gain party status through intervention in seeking the circuit court's order to permit that, once they've done that, then there's the notice of claim is simply it's not needed. There's no policy reason to have it there. Yet, because first of all, again, the city has been in negotiations. They know about the issue. They know about the petition to the Waste Facility Siting Board by all these parties. They participated in a hearing where all these issues were fully addressed. The city could have negotiated a settlement or otherwise addressed the matter consistent with 893.80 all the time these things are pending.
Now, but your statement of the issue and your response in your brief does not limit it to 227. In fact, you don't even cite 227. At least you don't cite it in your list of statutes.
No.
The issue as is compliance with the Wisconsin's Notice of Claim statute a necessary prerequisite to a counterclaim for declaratory relief against a municipality by an intervening or involuntary party. I don't know what an involuntary party is, but at least we'll take an intervening. So your statement would cover any intervening party in any civil action.
And I think, Judge, that is what I would ask this court to consider. So, again, we have...
So you're broader than 227.
Yes, I think, generally speaking, I think a specific statute should control over the general, in which case the procedure for 227 should control over 893. As a broader issue, whenever there's any statute that conflicts with 893.80, especially those that have a shorter time period, well, then they should control over 893.80, which would otherwise deprive parties of a remedy. And that's the real harm here. Any city that you file a claim against, you have to wait 120 days. In the meantime, the statute runs. They would never honor any claim. They could automatically defeat it. And that's, of course, absurd.
Well, the city had a response to that. They said, you file your notice, and then when your time periods run out, you bring a lawsuit, and then ask for a consolidation.
Well, you could file, suspend it, file the notice, and so long as you didn't have a problem there, and the court didn't dismiss it all, you know, right off the bat. That's somewhat of a procedural way of getting around it, but I think,
sure.
I think that is quite irregular. But some of these statutes... For example, an appeal from election recount by Board of Canvassers. That's an action that has to be brought against the municipality within 5 days, 7 days, a petition for a writ of mandamus, challenging the sufficiency of a recall petition. And many of these time periods are 10, 20, 30 days such that...
Maybe they don't apply.
Well, under DNR versus City of Waukesha, in the statutory language itself, it says in all cases, in all actions against any governmental entity. And I think all these statutes are against intergovernmental entities where you have the inconsistency. The other argument that I made regarding any type of a counterclaim or cross-claim, I'm asking this court to consider perhaps clarifying the City of Milwaukee case on the separate claims for monetary relief. City sues you for a zoning violation, and you sue the city for a tax rebate or a cracked sidewalk or something. Those are really separate causes of action that the trial court, anyways, would have the discretion to sever if it felt appropriate to get the first action running, or at least the circumstances under which a notice of claim perhaps should be appropriate. This case, there is no separate issue that was not raised by the City of Racine or the Town of Mount Pleasant before the before RAPE filed its cross claims for declaratory relief. In other words, it was simply saying, yes, we join in the other parties, we want the circuit court to look at the administrative decision, its jurisdiction, as well as make any ruling consistent with finding out what disqualifies a city from a negotiating context.
Mr. Hudick, do you want us to limit a holding to separate claims, or do you want us to limit a holding to claims for monetary relief? I'm not sure from what I just heard you say exactly what you're asking us to do.
Well, I see there seeing. I think there is some legitimate reason for the City of Milwaukee case saying if it's a separate claim altogether, there's separate facts and whatnot, that in that case, perhaps there is a reason to uphold the notice of claim statute in that instance. But otherwise, across the board, these inconsistent statutes should be reconciled. The 220, if a statute has a specific procedure like 227 does for appeals, that should be honored. And whenever a municipality brings up the subject matter of a claim, basically defines the issues, and parties come in and define the litigation to that issue, the notice of claim statute it doesn't make any sense.
What do you mean by confining it to that issue?
Well, for example, that perhaps is a good judgment call for a trial court as far as where it's deemed to be a separate case, where at least the other action perhaps could even be severed. In this case, it's very simple because we're challenging one rule or trying to hold one rule. In the instant case here, the city and Land Reclamation are arguing that if we want to participate in this declaratory action and 227 appeal, we would have to, in every case, file a notice of appeal before the administrative hearing saying that either we might appeal it if we lose, or if we win, we might join in and ask for declaratory relief if we lose. In this case, if we'd have won, we'd have been in court within 30 days. We might have seen a notice of claim defense at that point saying, you've got to wait 120. We'd be here on an easy statutory conflict for you to reconcile by choosing the specific statute over the general. But it's really unusual where, as a winning party, before an administrative process, you have to file a notice of claim simply to reserve your ability to intervene as a party. In this case, it should be noted that despite what was argued in the Land Reclamation's brief, is that the rate did file a notice of appearance and respond to the petition for review, asking this general type of relief. When the town of Mount Pleasant basically rephrased the issues a little broader to make sure that circuit court could decide the issue about standing, at that point we simply adopted their pleadings. Why at that point should we be kicked out? Because all along we were participating in trying to get a resolution of a single legal issue out of the Waste Facility Siting Board.
Suppose it never appeared before the board. Could you intervene?
At that point, yes, I think we could have intervened.
Okay, so this would cover someone who didn't appear before the board but who could intervene under the 227 provisions, your position?
Yes.
One of the things that concerns me about this case is the facts. The facts are so tantalizing because the claims, as you say, are almost plagiarized. The wherefore clauses are identical. It's nothing new, City of Racine. You've seen it before in Mount Pleasant. This is no new claim, no new argument, no new issue, all the same. And yet the way you framed the issue initially, dealing with counterclaims, declaratory judgment, intervening third parties, leads a classification. And so many cases within that classification of counterclaim, declaratory judgment, intervening third parties may not have the mirror images as exist in this fact situation, the exact same relief requested, the exact same issues. And yet it seems to me you're asking us to take a whole classification of cases and say it's no longer subject to 89380, even though there might be a separate issue, a different issue. Respond to that.
Yeah, very briefly, as I said the last time here, I'd like you to do both, because there's a lot of cases that will be in the pipeline because of 42 statutory inconsistencies with 893.80. So, yes, I would like this court to consider our broader ruling so our visits are less often on this particular statute, 893.80. But as far as the across claims and counterclaims here, they're also relevant because it's just hard to understand how an intervening party with party status trying to litigate the same issue as the municipality that started the suit, why they should be prevented from participating unless they go back to zero, ground zero, and file a notice of claim and start all over again. That simply doesn't make any sense. Any claim that the city affirmatively comes to court on and say we want a resolution, they should not be able to have a procedural defense against other parties who have an interest from coming on board and saying, yes, you described the issue, you set it out here, we want to participate in it, while they're saying we can go to court, but you can't because you didn't file
the
notice.
What if the intervening third party has a different issue?
If it has a different issue that's separate, well, then
it has common issues and a separate issue.
Well, that's a harder question to answer. Perhaps that should be left to the discretion of the trial court to the extent that it involves the same facts or the same issues. I'd like to have it across the board where the city opens the door to the lawsuit.
We can say this is, they have common issues, but there's also a separate issue the intervening third party might have. How are we to treat that then?
My initial response is if the city opens the door, it should be responsible in litigating without a notice of a claim defense any issue that substantially relates to the issue that they have affirmatively taken to court.
Well, that's your test, substantially relates. Where do you get that test from? So that you might have a body of law that deals with that test so that trial judges and appellate courts can use it. It has a familiar ring.
I confess that it's quite ambiguous and...
Let me address that for a moment. Here's my concern with it. You talk about the trial judge having discretion, but we're talking about whether or not jurisdictionally you're going to allow this to occur or not. It seems to me you need some hard and fast rules so that someone knows whether they need to have filed a notice of claim before filing the lawsuit or not. And the trial judges have that discretion, seems to me, making squishy an area that has to be certain.
It'd be best for us to be clean across the board. The city starts, anybody can raise the issue without
a notice of claim. That would include a dollar claim then?
It'd be simpler if that were the rule.
So anytime the broad rule, you've given us several broad rules. One broad rule is anytime the city starts it, you can bring in anything that you might bring against anyone else. I mean, that's one broad rule. So, any claim. Another broad rule would be city starts it, it has to be substantially related, right? Third broad rule is city starts it, you can bring in only that claim that relates directly to that claim that the city brought. Fourth broad rule, the city starts it, you can bring in anything that has a special statute, because the special statutes will trump 89380. Right? That's what I heard you say.
It's simplest for me to come and argue that we've complied with 227. That's the only exception that we want you to address.
Yeah,
except
that's the narrowest one. 227,
yes.
Intervening party directly relates to the issue for which the city sued. That's the narrowest, right?
Yes.
Why don't you argue, and you can think about this.
Thank you.
I'm going to tell you what I want you to think about. Why don't you argue that we ought to overrule DNR and say that this only applies to tort claims? Anyway, you can answer that in your 5 minutes.
Okay, thank you.
Thank you. Counsel for Racine, Mr. Wright, Daniel Wright.
Your Honors, I am Daniel Wright, City Attorney, representing the City of Racine in this case. Before proceeding with my prepared comments, I would just briefly like to respond to some of the commentary the court has just had.
I'm going to interrupt you. According to my notes, you have 25 minutes and that Mr. Jackson will take five.
Is that correct?
Okay, thank you.
Yes. The party here characterizing themselves as RAID is not a group that can be a party in, for example, a Waste Facility Siting Board proceeding, where only the local siting committee or the localities can be parties. And I think this is where some of the confusion begins. The group of citizens that constitutes RAID could have, at any point during the 4 or 5 years in which the siting agreement was being negotiated, could have brought a claim against the city saying, we don't like the way you're doing it, and we're going to sue you if you don't change your negotiations to listen to us more carefully. They did not do that. Later on, when Mount Pleasant, with a letter, submitted it to the Waste Facility Siting Board, the board did not actually have an administrative proceeding as you and I know it. What they had was an informal proceeding in which they listened to the people that came. They did not take sworn testimony, did not allow cross-examination, and they asked for some written supplement to their record before issuing a letter. Now, that letter was not a decision, as their attorney later characterized when he obtained dismissal from the lawsuit. The board did not issue a decision. It simply was a letter of support, supporting Mount Pleasant's concept of what they thought should happen. Now, is there a conflict between Chapter 227 and RAID under these circumstances? No, there isn't. 227.53, I believe, Prens 2, specifically allows for participation of aggrieved persons in a proceeding which would be among parties. Rate could have gone in, presented their ideas, presented their arguments, not only to the Waste Facility Siting Board, but I believe also to Racine County Circuit Court, without bringing an actual claim by counterclaim or cross-claim against the city.
Okay, that's reaching the issue I raised with counsel, namely, isn't it just a negative to the claim that the Racine had?
It may be a negative.
Racine asked for a declaratory judgment that the siting board acted improperly. Isn't that what Rate's asking, saying the board acted properly?
Well, that's one of the things Rate was saying, but you also have to remember, Rate is not the governmental body which was on the siting board, namely Mount Pleasant, and the issues as to standing arise as to should they have brought their claims.
But nobody is arguing that. Your briefs aren't arguing that they're not the right party before the circuit court. Your briefs have gone right to the merit. The merit is 89380. None of this is being argued that the circuit court should not have let them intervene. That's what I hear you saying now. It's too late, isn't it?
No, I'm not. What I'm doing is responding to your question as to when Rate comes in and says the same thing Mount Pleasant has said, is that the same? And I'm saying it's not the same when Rate says it, because Rate is a specific group that's different than Mount Pleasant. I'm not saying in this case we're arguing over standing of Rate. That was decided in the lower court. But when we talk about parties and people bringing claims, and when we talk about Chapter 227 relief, it's relevant, I believe, to consider where is this claim coming from. And they are allowed to participate as a participant in the proceedings, short of bringing a counterclaim or cross-claim without bringing a claim against the city. And I guess that's my point. They could do that. They could participate. They're not required to bring a claim against the city in that circumstance.
So suppose they just filed. They intervened and they said, we disagree with the city. We think the city ought to lose, right?
Correct.
That would have been okay.
Well, of course, you know, we would have had to look at the facts then across the board, but in my view, under Chapter 227.53, that may well be okay, because
what about under 89380?
Well, under 89380, it probably would also be okay, because they're not bringing an actual claim for relief against the government body.
Well, then why don't we just say that they mislabeled their answer, and that they really don't have a counterclaim, because it's exactly the same as saying, no, we disagree with you, and that this whole thing is moot.
Well, it is moot, actually, because Mount Pleasant and the city
settled. I understand that. But as to this legal issue, rate hasn't settled.
Well, I mean, that's one of the difficult questions on the claim
statute. But that's not before us either.
No.
So what is before us is a very simple, at least on the surface, issue. If it's a counterclaim and it's exactly the same as a negative, that is, no, that we disagree with the city's statement of the law, why should they file a 89380 notice of claim?
Because the public policies underlying 89380 should be adhered to give the city an opportunity to consider the claim, to consider whether it should litigate the claim or settle the claim, to allow the city to investigate. And remember, here we're talking about a separate sort of party that the city could investigate and negotiate with them and have the opportunity to either avoid litigation or decide to pursue it and make provision for the cost of doing either. And I think those public policy reasons are really the crux of why this situation should be found in favor of the city.
So what rule do you think we should state? If you should win, what should be the rule?
Section 89380 applies to claims in equity. It applies to counterclaims and cross-claims. brought in a suit which has been instituted by the city. You should uphold your ruling in Milwaukee v. Milwaukee Civic Developments, Inc., as well as DNR.
Well, what if this is really not a counterclaim and cross-claim? You seem to indicate it's not, that it was misfiled, mislabeled, right?
Well, I'm not saying that. I'm saying that they could have participated without alleging specific relief against the city. They could participate, provide their views to the court, supporting Mount Pleasant's claims and counterclaims.
As a party?
Yes, as a party.
So your position is that DNR and Alkenbleck govern, and we fall under DNR as to all claims, and Alkenbleck doesn't govern this case?
There is no statute that specifically provides, as the statute in Alkenbleck provides, nor is there a statute as provided in the case Little Sisabagama Lake, which was a tax appeals case where Section 70.11 contains all the elements that 89380 contains. There simply is not the opportunity for municipalities to have use of the underlying public policies in a case like this without a claim first.
Well, why not? If you take as a given, this is the same issue, nothing new. You say the county doesn't, the city doesn't have use of these underlying investigation and negotiation. How would the city have investigated this any differently, since it is the exact same issue and claim as Mount Pleasant? How would your investigation have been different?
By investigating the nature of the claimants, the location of the claimants. I mean, Mount Pleasant, as a governmental body, apparently has felt by these claimants that they're different than these specific residents.
Well, they're different. I mean, they have different bodies. Their voice may sound different, but the words are the same. So why would you investigate the claims, the words of their claims, any differently? Why would you negotiate the words of their claims any differently if they're the exact same words?
Because in negotiating for the siting agreement, if it's clear that there are nearby neighbors that have specific demands, for example, the dump maybe opens too early on Saturday mornings, they want it to open a half an hour later, where perhaps Mount Pleasant, as a governmental body, has an interest in it being open earlier so they can use it. These are exactly the types of things that a claims investigation will reveal and allow appropriate negotiation with the siting committee.
Well, then you take disagreement that the claims are not the same. You're telling me they're different. They involve different people. They involve different locations. So my underlying premise that the claims are identical is incorrect.
It depends on, I guess, your meaning of the word claim in a very specific sense versus a broad sense, but that's right. If they're asking for declaratory judgment, their view of what this judgment would result in would be perhaps would have different parameters than Mount Pleasant's view of what the result of the declaratory judgment would be, even though they're both saying the same thing in the claims.
Well, what's so different? Racine's either going to get 4 reps on it or not get 4 reps on it. Is that the same for Mount Pleasant and for Rate?
Well, Rate doesn't get any reps on it.
No, I understand that. But Rate will or will not knock out Racine. That's the issue here, isn't it?
Well, that would be the fundamental issue. And I guess before my time runs out, I'd like to just clarify a few of the facts that...
Well, would you stay with that question? I mean, I still don't. It's a follow-up, and I don't understand how you would investigate or negotiate any differently the issue of whether Racine should have 4 members on the board. You say there are different parameters. I still don't understand.
But that's the issue. How would you negotiate that differently?
Well,
how would you investigate that differently?
Okay, I already expressed partly how it would be investigated, but remember, the overall context of this case is a case which, in fact, was ultimately settled with Mount Pleasant Land Reclamation and the city agreeing on terms by which Mount Pleasant said, okay, we'll go along with the siting agreement and what we negotiated. Now, when you add the rate group into the mix, Rate's position has been, as stated in his brief, this cannot be settled by negotiation. What I'm saying is give it an opportunity to learn what the issues are that underlie their unhappiness that then makes them want to throw Racine people off the board. What can we do in order to make them happy and then make them satisfied with the way the siting committee is made
up? Let me ask you a question. If this situation had arisen prior to the DNR case, was there any authority, do you believe you had authority to be able to argue what you're arguing today?
Well, if it didn't apply, if the claim statute did not apply to claims in equity, probably not.
If the language in the DNR case, if I were to say it is perhaps overbroad in opening up the notice of claim statute to all cases, but if really what that case stands for is saying there has to be a notice of claim filed, either there are money damages requested or fines or forfeitures or other financial requests, would that be inconsistent with any other case other than Waukesha, DNR versus Waukesha?
Well, the case is that
I know it doesn't say that. I'm just asking. This is a hypothetical.
Right. I'm not sure if there have been later cases that have been decided strictly on matters in equity, but don't be mistaken. Equitable results have financial impacts.
Oh, I understand
and
that.
And in this case, if the siting agreement had to be renegotiated, there could be considerable financial impact on Mount Pleasant as well as the city in preparing and planning for some other landfill expansion.
Well, would you concur that the DNR case is certainly at minimum problematic in that there are numbers of causes of action that can arise that, I mean, the public records was one of them, public record demand, but other kinds of things for which there are statutory times and time limitations that conflict with the notice of claim statute?
That is problematic, but under Chapter 227, as we're dealing with here, I don't believe that it's a problem insofar as...
there may be problems with other cases, for example, cases in the pipeline or other cases that are out there in other chapters.
Well, for example, as mentioned in the zoning area, there may be problems, but again, those situations have already developed very specific facts as to what is being contested and what relief is demanded.
So you think that, let me ask you, if you were sitting here concerned, and I'll tell you I'm concerned with the impact of the DNR case on areas that obviously were not at issue in that case, and maybe not even an issue in your case, what might you suggest to try to fix this so we don't have 10,000 litigation satellite cases out there on interpreting, trying to argue what DNR meant in terms of vis-a-vis the statute? Do you have a suggestion?
Well, perhaps the legislature should fix it.
Well, yeah, but let's assume they don't.
If they don't, then on a case-by-case basis, your court will have to deal with it, I would say.
There's no other fix that you can think of?
Other than a legislative fix, if you were to go partway and say zoning, this in that case won't apply, the claims rule doesn't apply, obviously that's not going to do it. If you wiped out DNR, I don't think that would make sense because there are substantial policy reasons why it's a good idea to require claims.
Well, it seemed to have been working before DNR. I mean, we didn't get cases. It was taught, you filed, you didn't file. We knocked you out. We said no deal.
Yeah, that's why I asked the question earlier. I mean, until DNR came along, and that was a case involving a request for fine and forfeiture, if there wasn't, if the relief was not obtained immediately, but it didn't seem that prior to that time that there were any problems, or at least people were making that argument that there was a problem.
Right, just because there were no cases coming to
doesn't
you,
mean it
certainly doesn't mean there wasn't cost to government, which is pressured with financial problems these days, and there is cost in equity classes.
One of the primary rules of statutory interpretation is to try to, is that statutes that are seemingly in conflict with each other, we have to try to interpret them so that they're not. Now, what your learned counsel is arguing here is that there are statutes that are absolutely in conflict, if we're going to read each one literally. Do you agree with that?
I would say there are some statutes in conflict, as the Open Meetings and Open Records statute was.
But this is not.
But I don't believe Chapter 227 is in conflict.
You can comply with both. That's what your brief seemed to indicate.
Yes.
You'd have to consolidate, ultimately, to make any sense out of this.
That's right, and that's what this court suggested. I believe it was in Milwaukee, the Milwaukee Civic Developments.
Well, what's the matter with saying that in a 227 appeal that an intervening party that takes exactly the same position as other parties, or that is just negating the city's complaint, needn't file a claim? That's very narrow.
Well, that's right, but we're back around to the same circle. A different party, even though they're saying, I want X, just like the other one, has a different perspective on it and a different
sure,
claim.
Sure, and a different interest. And Mount Pleasant might be very willing to make a deal with the city of Racine, and Rate won't. But that's life. And that would have been true even if they filed the notice. You'd be stuck with that.
No, if they had filed the notice, we may not have been in court with Rate. We may have been able to work things out, just as later they were worked out with Mount Pleasant.
Well, still have the opportunity to work it out. I don't see that's a difference. So you don't like any of the suggestions that your opposing counsel gave?
I think that's a fair statement, Your Honor.
Okay. You can't come up with any one of them, or any of the five, or whatever. Okay. Fair enough.
Okay. In the short moments remaining, I would like to clarify facts which were mentioned by Mr. Hudak that I think disguise the history of this matter. The city of Racine didn't grab the landfill and annex it. Some time ago, the owner of the landfill, LRL, at that point, had started an expansion process, and they ended it. They terminated it. They then petitioned for annexation to the city. It's a legal process. It's not an underhanded process. The city finally did agree and annexed the landfill. It did not take with it neighbors, the residents, which the city could under the statutes. The city did not. Simply limited it to the landfill. And then the process for expansion was restarted under Chapter 144 at that time. I believe that it should not be inferred that there is some evil purpose in the city's annexing the landfill. It was all done according to statute. Here we are now. The city had four people on the committee as provided by the statute. With that, I will turn the rest of my time over to Mr. Jackson.
Thank you, Mr. Wright. Mr. Jackson, you represent the Land Reclamation Company.
Yes, I do. Brad Jackson, the law firm of Foley and Lardner. Let me try to answer some of the questions that have been posed to date with maybe a slightly different viewpoint. Chapter 227 action, that was certainly among the claims brought by both LRC and the city in this case, but it was not the only claims. There were also certiorari claims as well as declaratory judgment claims. Focusing on the 227 claim, I frankly don't see a party like Rate either filing a notice of appearance because they were a party before the agency below, or intervening by permission of the court as 227 allows. I don't see that party having a quote-unquote claim against the municipality that initiated the 227 action. We're here today because RAID filed a separate claim. They didn't merely participate in a 227 administrative action. They filed a separate and independent claim, styled as a counterclaim, against the city in addition to participating in the 227 review proceeding. Let me try to answer Justice Bradley's question of why not. Why not let RAID come in, participate in 227, and file additional claims on top of that if they're just mirroring another party's claims? I think it's more practical than anything else. By filing a separate claim, you're adding a party with something to say about the disposition of the case. Because RAID did in fact participate as a party below, that's what happened. This case was settled as to all of the other parties except RAID, and but for the dismissal on the notice of claim grounds, I don't know where this case would be at this point, whether we'd have a settlement or not.
Why don't you argue that they're not a good party? That is, they should never have been allowed to intervene. Why are we here on notice of claims instead of intervention?
We argued below that they lack standing, primarily for the grounds that they represent their interests to be adequately represented. We made the judgment not to pursue that argument here.
Okay, so we're here recognizing them as a valid party.
As far as standing goes, yes. Yes, they have interests not adequately represented. That's correct.
Okay.
But again, even though they have the same claim, quote-unquote, as the town of Mount Pleasant, by making them file a notice of claim before filing a counterclaim, it makes sense to me because that raises the stakes. It adds a party to the case, another claim that has to be settled. And while it didn't happen in this case, hindsight's always 20/20. It would give the city a chance to consider whether or not, with a new party, independent claim, it would make sense to try to cut to the chase, settle the case now rather than litigate. Again, it didn't happen here, but the policy and purposes of the notice of claim statute kick in when you have an intervener raising a new claim. What rule might we apply? I agree that the DNR language of all actions overstates the case. The statute itself does not apply to all actions. The statute itself begins with the word except, as I recall. So that obviously cannot be taken literally. But the court in Auchinleck recognized that where you have two statutes and the party cannot comply with both, one's got to give. And I think it reached the right result in applying the more specific statute over the general statute in the event of a statutory conflict. That's a correct result because it still leaves the issue in the hands of the legislature. This case really rises and falls on the City of Milwaukee case, a 20-plus year precedent holding that the notice of claim statute applies to a counterclaim, even one that goes straight to the heart of the action brought by the city, the municipality, in the first place. The court recognized the potential futility of following the notice of claim statute in a given case, but stated simply that that was a question more properly addressed by the legislature. So I would...
Counsel, you refer to the statute itself, and I'm looking at 893-81A. Why don't we just say in this case, look, that statute says you've got to give the 120-day notice, but failure to give the requisite notice, the statute says, shall not bar action on the claim if the city had actual notice of the claim, and if it's the same claim the city did, and the claimant shows to the satisfaction of the court the delay or failure to give the requisite notice has not been prejudicial. So why don't we just use the words of the statute and say, look here, in this instance, RAID didn't file within 120 days, but the city had actual notice of the claim, it's the same claim, and the city's not prejudiced. Why not proceed on the words of the statute with this case?
In fact, we have, because the circuit court did rule that RAID satisfied those standards with respect to subsection A. But with respect to subsection B, the requirement that a notice of claim be filed and be disallowed, if nothing but by the passage of 120 days, subsection B does not include that out. And so read strictly, you've got to file the notice of claim before bringing an independent claim against the city.
Because you need to give them the 120 days.
You need to give them the 120 days.
You have to have a starting point.
Yes.
What would have kept them from filing it 200 days ago?
Well, I don't know if they could do it now, but they certainly could have done it then. This action began in November of 1994. They were not granted party status until April of 1995. What stopped them from filing a notice of claim at the time they first attempted to intervene in this case? Nothing. Now, whether or not they could begin again today, you've got subsection A with the 120-day after injury rule, but the circuit court's already ruled for them on that, at least back in 1994-95. I don't know.
It seems like a farce, though, to say, okay, now, but they haven't filed the 120, they haven't filed the claim to give us an opportunity to do their bidding.
Well, I think you have to look at...
You haven't been doing their bidding for 2 years. You think the filing of that claim 120 days ago is going to change that?
I think you have to look at more in the abstract as opposed to what actually happened in this case, because Rate was a party in this case, and things transpired. The purpose of the rule is to give the city a chance. And here, I don't think anyone can claim that the city had a chance to settle with Rate prior to their motion to intervene in the court case. They didn't have a claim against the city. All that we had was parties arguing about the validity of a state agency's action. In fact, it wasn't even until April of 1995 that Rate filed a separate and independent claim for relief against the city. Prior to that time, Rate's only argument was that the Waste Facility Siting Board acted properly. And the court disposed of that by finding the board didn't act and dismissed the petitions for review and certiorari actions that the city and LRC had begun. And that wiped out that whole chapter of the case.
Well, Mr. Jackson, I'm somewhat confused, which I guess isn't unique. I heard Mr. Hudick in his argument state that one of the holdings that he might be in agreement with is that if we said that the specific statute of limitations controlled over the general notice of claim. This was in response, I believe, to Justice Bradley's question, what do you want us to hold? Then you were asked, what do you want us to hold? And I heard you say, apply the specific statute over the general.
Yes.
Sounds like the same thing to me.
It's the same rule,
yeah.
But it wouldn't apply in this case.
Okay, so he thinks it applies in this case, and you don't think it does. Why doesn't it apply in this case?
To be involved in Chapter 227 action, you are not filing a claim against the petitioning municipality. You are intervening or appearing to say whether or not the state agency's action was correct or not. That's not filing a claim against the municipality that has filed a petition for review. It's different when you try to add on to that appearance or intervention separate and independent claims for relief against the municipality.
That's the same argument your counsel for the city of Racine made. And so I say to you the same thing I said to that counsel, namely, so they goofed. They labeled something a counterclaim or cross-claim. They didn't have to do that at all. All they had to do was intervene to say that the administrative agency was correct. Right? Had they done that, you wouldn't be here. Is that right?
We would not be here because the petitions for review were dismissed on the court's finding that there was no action to begin with. They could have appealed that decision.
Yeah, and they did.
No.
Well, they appealed their part of the decision that threw them out of court.
Yes. They could have appealed that. But they would not have a separate independent claim for relief against the city.
So you're...
But it would not involve the declaratory relief as to the underlying merits of the case.
No, but we're not anywhere near the underlying merits of the case yet. This case has nothing to do with that. It's on a technical point of 890-380. And your position is they could have gone in, but they did it the wrong way.
Well,
they could have avoided 893-80.
But they would not have a separate claim pending against the city. They would not represent another party that would either have to win or lose or we'd have to settle with.
Well, if they intervene in our party in the circuit court, why don't you have to? Why don't they represent a separate party?
Because the petitions for review were dismissed. That leaves nothing that Ray was involved in at that point. Only by virtue of their counterclaim.
They could have appealed that. Okay.
Yes. Right. Only by virtue of their counterclaim for declaratory relief did they remain.
Thank you.
Thank you.
There's a couple quick preliminary points I'd like to make. First,